It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week, Chef Marcus Samuelson gives us a personal tour of his home territory, Harlem. Now, with Marcus, you know the food spots are going to be dynamite. But what's the scene like?
We see Uptown's Anna Wintour, which is Lana Turner. That is probably coming with a big hat and incredible, impeccable dress. We'll see a lot of musicians going or coming from a gig. You're going to see some dapper men in three-piece suits and blue hats. Blue hats the way Harlem only makes sense in Harlem. Looks clownish in other neighborhoods. You're going to see a hint of Senegalese patterns at the African market, the Nigerian patterns. And that's my Harlem.
More with Marcus Samuelson. And why no love for the cosmopolitan? This hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Chef Marcus Samuelson has had quite a journey. Born in Ethiopia, raised in Sweden, evolved into a famous chef in the United States, and then proudly made New York City's Harlem his home. His two eateries, City Bird Rotisserie and Red Rooster, which was named for a famous old Harlem speakeasy, are gathering places for locals and visitors. So when our contributor Melissa Clark, the New York Times columnist and a born and bred New Yorker, wanted to check out the changing scene in Harlem, she immediately thought of Marcus. Melissa asked him to give us a tour of the streets he walks and the places he loves.
Marcus, hello and welcome.
Hello. How are you, Melissa?
I'm great. And I am so excited to talk to you about Harlem. Harlem, which is also dear to my heart.
Yes.
But I want to hear how it's dear to your heart. Can you take us through a tour of your Harlem?
Yes. I think you would come on the 2 of the 3, and I would meet you on top of the subway, and maybe we'd have a cocktail at the Rooster, and then we walk straight to the counter at Sylvia. We'd just sit in the counter that I know that you've been to many, many times.
Yes.
And we will maybe have oxtail. Maybe we'd argue, you know, about who's going to suck the bone or not, you know, all of these things, you know, and then we'll listen to this sort of this background noise of conversation at that counter because everything happening at Sylvia's counter. Later on, we probably walk down by the Studio Museum, we'll check out the new show and take a left on Adam Clayton Powell. I would point out the Apollo and who's coming up, but we would take a left and go down to Paris Blues, which is always open to the most amazing late night music. We'll go left from there down to 116 and we'll just touch on a little West Africa, where it smells a little funky from the fermented shrimp paste, and you have really good sort of jollof.
What's jollof?
Jollof is a Senegalese dish, or actually throughout the whole West African. You have incredible like jollof rice, and you have these mafé, this incredible Senegalese food that is just right there on somewhere between St. Nick and Frederick Douglass. We'll head left and go to La Marqueta. And La Marqueta is this incredible East, beautiful Latin Harlem where you can find the roots are really Puerto Rican Harlem, but it's now throughout immigration really evolved into a Mexican Harlem. And an immigrant Harlem that is so delicious. We walk down 116, we go down to Pleasant Avenue, and I point out the new Patsy's that's been there forever. You might even see some of the new Mexican street food that is there. And then when we're all the way down to Pleasant Avenue, we stay at Rayos, and we maybe get a seat at the bar, listen to some Italian-American music, get some good meatballs, and that's my Harlem.
That sounds like a heck of a night. I want to come.
That's a good night. That's a good night.
And who do we see? Who do we pass on the street? Tell me about the people.
We see Uptown's Anna Wintour, which is Lana Turner. That is probably coming with a big hat and incredible, impeccable dress. We'll see a lot of musicians that I say hi to. They have, whether it's their saxophone or the guitar on their back, or the trumpet on the back. They're going or coming from a gig, maybe just been to Showman's, going over to Ginny's, but, you know, always in conversation for the next gig, talking to another musician, which space was happening, which supper club was cooler than the other. You're going to see some dapper men in three-piece suits and blue hats. Blue hats, the way Harlem only makes sense in Harlem. Looks clownish in other neighborhoods. You're going to see a hint of Senegalese patterns at the African market, the Nigerian patterns. You'll also see young kids on bikers and skateboards, and, you know, sort of racing each other. You see strollers, young new families talking, you know, sipping the new latest latte or frappuccino. But they're engaging and talking to each other, not just at each other.
And that's what makes Harlem so vibrant.
Absolutely.
How long have you been living in Harlem, and have you seen a lot of changes?
I've lived in Harlem for about 12 years, and I've seen enormous amount of changes. But also the core of it is really protected like a flower, right? People really work towards protecting the core through community boards, through churches, through the small businesses. So the core of Harlem stays not in one place, but yet sort of really of the same, but yet ready to move on to the next era, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can see almost this David and Goliath fight in terms of whose Harlem is it? Where does gentrification land? How hard does it push? And all of this is obviously part of the changes. And when you walk on Lenox and you see the brownstones, who do they belong to today? Who built them?
Mm.
You see the new condos and co-ops on top of them. You see Central Park to the south, and you see Schaumburg to the north. It's America. When you see Harlem, you see the world, but you also see America.
Marcus, race is so much on our minds today.
Yeah.
We're always thinking about how people are connecting to one another. What are you seeing from Harlem?
Sure. Well, it is, you know, we have Black Lives Matter movement constantly come to our restaurant, and I think it's beautiful. They want to express themselves, and they look at our restaurant as a place to do that. And it's always peaceful. But I think race was definitely on my mind when I built the restaurant too. We take for granted today that we all can eat together because of civil rights movement, because of people like Leah Chase and Sylvia's and so on. So, of course, it was something that I thought about. I thought about it like I wanted a restaurant that was of African-American culture, but it was for everyone. And the fact that you could see people and see that people can see each other, think about that big bar, that voluptuous bar. It has every nationality and race you can possibly think about at any given time. Well, that's an important statement. There is a stigma. There is a, if you're only seeing black people either around entertainment or around ending up when it's been around a negative news, it's important to have other places to meet people and have a glass of wine and see like-minded or sitting. There's a reason why those tables are very close next to each other. So people are talking and hearing conversations and like, you know what? We are more like-minded. You know what? A little restaurant can actually create a dialogue of seeing each other versus talking at each other.
And there's nothing like breaking bread amidst different people, right, to bring everybody together.
Absolutely. And you know what? Some bourbon on top of that is not a bad idea.
That sounds like a great idea. Marcus, thank you so much. It was great talking with you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Marcus Samuelson's latest book is The Red Rooster Cookbook. Melissa Clark's latest is Cook This Now. Head to splendidtable.org for a look at Marcus's signature fried chicken recipe from Red Rooster. He calls it fried yard bird. And be sure to have a listen to the rest of Melissa's conversation with Marcus. He talks about how he ended up with a restaurant in Harlem in the first place and what being a restaurateur in that neighborhood really means. You can find it at splendidtable.org. cast iron skillets nearly brought down Melanie Dunay, the celebrity photographer and one of our contributors. She decided that she needed to up her cooking game, so she started by doing an inventory of her equipment. And that's when she ran smack into those two cast iron skillets that she'd abandoned years ago. Why? Well, she admits they were scary. Melanie is not alone. I mean, for some cooks, the cast iron skillet is essential as a stove. It's coddled and beloved. And for the rest of us, a cast iron skillet is just too needy. So it's banished to that dusty shelf. But Melanie was tenacious about upping her game. She got together with Charlotte Druckmann, author of Stir, Sizzle, Bake, Recipes for Your Cast Iron Skillet, all about baking in cast iron. Something Melanie found intriguing.
Charlotte, nice to have you here.
I'm glad to be here.
So Charlotte, what is up with you and cast iron?
My history with cast iron is actually pretty short. I took a crash course to write this book, and now I love it, and I'm obsessed with it, and I've inadvertently begun collecting it. I think it is probably the most versatile cooking material that you can use in your kitchen, and I think it's especially good for home cooks, and it's such a good baking vessel.
It's true. I feel like this is sort of a extension of the baking sheet.
Yes, it is. But it gets hotter and it's got slightly higher sides. So you get those really beautifully caramelized edges and that crispiness. And I kind of liken it to searing savory food the same way you think about searing a steak. When you want to make perfect brownies, you're essentially trying to get the equivalent of a sear on your brownie, right? Because you want that good crust, but then you want them really melty and almost raw inside. And I think a skillet, once you get the hang of sort of the timing of, because it gets so very hot and it stays so very hot, you can nail things like brownies and cookies and things where you want that really soft, gooey middle, but then that really nice crust.
So, all right, let me get some details on this cast iron thing. Does size matter?
Yes, it does, but it doesn't matter in terms of like how you treat the pan. You're going to treat the pan the same no matter how big or small it is. So in terms of size, it's more like how many people you're feeding and the kinds of things you're getting done. So the book is everything was done on a 10-inch cast iron skillet, and I think that that's perfect for baking. But I think if you're using it to make meals and you've got a family of four, I would say you want a 12-inch. So I recommend people having a 10-inch and a 12-inch. 10-inch will feed two people a meal. 12-inch, four. All baking can be done in a 10.
And what about old versus new?
Oh, This is the thing where I get myself in trouble because we don't all have access to old pans. My mother had, I don't know why, threw out or something her old cast iron pans, which means that she's just got a bunch of semi-new pans and I have no heirlooms. To do this book, I went and got some vintage pans because I really wanted to know what it was like to cook on new cast iron and old cast iron. It is such a dream to work on vintage cast iron that's been well cared for. And it's relatively easy to fix up an old piece. It's just, they get this beautiful patina. They get smooth. I say it almost looks like poured chocolate. But we don't all have access to that, and people are making new pans. And Lodge is probably the most accessible. I think it's like $15 for a 10-inch Lodge. They come pre-seasoned. Lodge used to make pans back when cast iron was really this great American export. And they're the only remaining company that still makes them, but they've changed the formula a bit. So I still think the vintage ones are better. That said, the ones they're making now are, you can do everything on them and they're pretty easy to treat. But then you've got a few companies, like I really love Finex in Portland, where they studied cast iron like it was a thesis. And the owner, Mike Whitehead, collected all of this cast iron. He became obsessed with it. And then he melted it down to make all these prototypes. And they're making these beautiful pans, and they're more expensive, but they're the kinds of pans that you will want to keep and then pass on.
I actually cooked from your book last night, and I followed your cooking rules. First, I seasoned the pan, which was so easy. But tell me, I mean, just give me a quick rundown of your rules.
Okay, so the main thing you're always trying to do with cast iron is to avoid rust, rust is the devil. Rust is the thing that makes you have to start from scratch and reseason the pan all over again. And the reason you don't want to do that is that your seasoning is what makes your pan nonstick. And this reaction happens when you get your pan really, really hot, and then you add oil to it, and it polymerizes. So what we call seasoning is a layer of polymerized fat that's become water resistant, which means that it will protect the pan from rust, but it'll also help release food from your pan. So you want to keep the seasoning intact and at the same time stave off rust. And it's basically just a constant making sure you rinse your pan well, you dry it, and then you oil it.
I was so surprised that I was allowed to use soap.
Yeah, that's completely safe for your skillet. What you don't want to do is put it in the dishwasher. Like, that's the worst thing you could possibly do.
And the preheating, that was surprising to me, sort of the build of the heat.
Yes, the preheating is for a number of reasons. First of all, if you add something cold to a cold pan and then put it in the oven, more likely than not, it's just going to stick, which I learned the hard way. But the other reason you want to slowly preheat your pan, it's better for the pan in terms of hot spots developing, especially if you're doing something on a stove like making a flatbread. You want to heat the pan slowly, and you also kind of want to move it around the flame. And that will help the pan heat evenly, because one of the few things that cast iron doesn't have going for it is that it does not heat evenly. It gets really hot. It stays really hot, but it's not the most even heating device.
Okay. So the baking part was fascinating to me. What should I make? What are your favorite recipes?
Well, there are a few in that first chapter that's devoted to flatbreads that I really love, including a recipe for lefse that's got saffron in it. But probably the most fun recipe, and it's one that you build up to, is the cornflake cake, which is actually a layer cake that you make in the skillet, and it's covered in cornflakes, and it's just delicious and a surprise.
Which I am so making. Charlotte, thank you so much. You have demystified the skillet for me, and I'm excited to get baking.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Charlotte Druckman is author of Stir, Sizzle, Bake. Melanie Dune is creator of My Last Supper. Now, you can find Charlotte's recipe for cornflake and milk cake at splendidtable.org. Coming up, why do bartenders hate the Cosmopolitan so much? I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Beth Dooley grew up shopping farm stands with her grandmother and learning from her how to cook by instinct. Curiously, though, what actually turned her into a food writer was a move to frigid Minnesota with her husband. And unlike a lot of us who came here and complained about winter nonstop for several years, Beth dug in. She cooked to make this new place home, and she wrote. In little time, she knew nearly every farmer in the farmer's market. Soon, Beth was walking their fields with them, working with artisans, and teaching kids how to plant and grow their food and how to cook it. And she wrote, and continues to write, for magazines, newspapers, blogs, and cookbooks. Her new book is In Winter's Kitchen, Growing Roots and Breaking Bread in the Northern Heartland. Beth, it's so good to have you here.
Oh, Lynn, thank you. It's lovely to be here. Thanks.
I understand that when you were in school, you were born and raised in New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
And you would secretly tuck the joy of cooking into your school bag and pull it out and hide it during study hall as you read it.
I did. I read it like a novel. You know,
how old were you?
Oh, I think I was about 14 years old.
Uh-huh.
And I was fascinated by it. And of course, that first joy had things in it like how to cook a squirrel. You know, I mean,
yes, that's true. Yeah, right.
So it really engaged my imagination in a pretty profound way. And I also found
reading recipes so comforting? I think it may be because a recipe is really just a memory of a happy meal. And so they're stories with happy endings. And I would read them and imagine what that meal would be like and then get excited and sometimes try and recreate them. But I just entered another world. And when you're reading recipes from not only your own country, but other countries, you get a glimpse of different cultures, too. And that was fascinating to me.
So you get married, you go to college, and you're dropped in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And you have some preconceptions about what you might be facing?
Totally. I mean, this is the land of soy and corn where my father couldn't remember how to pronounce the name of the city we'd arrived in. He kept calling it Mindianapolis. And my brother gave us that poster that the New Yorker had on the front cover that showed L.A. on one side and New York on the other side with nothing in between except the thin ribbon that was the Mississippi
River. Yeah, I remember
that
poster. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I thought, wow, where am I? And it took me a long time to get my legs here. I mean, the first place we went to eat out was Becky's Cafeteria. I don't know if you remember that at all.
No, I don't. But,
oh, it was one of those places where it was velvet curtains. You walked in, and at the host stand, there was a Bible open to Jeremiah 13:42 or something, and big, long steam table. And the food wasn't terrible, but it was steam food. But they always had beautiful pastries. They had wonderful pies and things like that, and really good bread. And I thought that was interesting. And then I hit the farmer's market, and I felt like I'd come home because the farmer's market was sort of representative of the kinds of food that I had eaten with my grandmother. That, you know, I would go and meet these farmers and talk to them about their crops and what was happening in their fields and bring this food home. And all of a sudden, food tasted like food again, because I was of the generation, and so many of us are, where we have this vague memory of farm fresh food, and then we live through this period of convenience food.
Yeah.
And when you taste something that's grown locally, there's a tremendous difference. And that kind of made me curious about why that's so. You know, then you begin to peel back the onion and try to understand what defines flavor, and that leads you into all this other information around food. And so that's sort of what happened.
That was the path.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the book, you write about individual foods.
Yes.
Apples, wheat,
right.
Chestnuts. But what ends up happening in each one of those chapters is, I mean, you're talking about government policy.
Yes.
You're talking about what farmers deal with. You're talking about things from several different points of view.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, you really started digging.
Yeah.
Was there any one thing that set that off?
There was. You know, the first real big project I had, because having fallen in love with reading cookbooks, I decided early on I really wanted to write cookbooks.
Right.
And I got to be friends with Lucia Watson. Lucia's restaurant was really the first farm-to-table restaurant in the Twin Cities. And Lucia was known as the Alice Waters of this region.
Mm-hmm.
And so she also understood, too, as a chef, that there was a big difference in the carrot that she bought from California versus the carrot that was grown down the street, just flavor-wise. And her whole intent was to provide and cook with the best food she possibly could. And as I began to meet the farmers that she was dealing with and understanding both her point of view as a restaurateur and also my issues as a home cook, how that might affect, you know, what happens to our local economy when we are more intentional about who we buy from.
One of the things you talk about, though, is although you're writing about Minnesota, you talk about how this could be anywhere in the United States.
That's exactly right. And that was one of the impetuses for writing the book. Just being curious about where things come from and beginning to ask questions revealed so much to me. There's so much that is right here available to us, things that grow right outside our back door, things that people are doing that are really phenomenal, very innovative, really interesting.
Give me some instances. They'll be about Minnesota, could be around the corner from anyone.
I mean, one person we don't hear very much about in Minnesota is a professor named Don Weiss, who's been engaged with the Land Stewardship Project, Wes Jackson's work on perennializing wheat, for instance. And it's phenomenal. And that's a crop that would really change the wheat industry, because Don's argument is that we can't ask farmers to change their practices overnight, but what we can do is begin to research those plants that will make a dramatic difference both in the quality of our food but how our land is used. But we have to give them different crops. And so that's been the trajectory of his life for the past, 30 or 40 years. He's a phenomenal human being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's a lot of this work that's going on that we don't hear about because it's not quite big news yet.
Yeah.
But it will be.
So you're saying that what they're working on for all this time is a wheat that you plant and it comes back every year. You don't have to buy seeds.
Correct.
You don't have to replant.
That's exactly right. Think about it. Wheat's a grass.
And our lawn comes back every year.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Huh. It's a phenomenal product. It's called Kernza. And we'll start seeing it in the grocery stores pretty soon.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if it could be a perennial, that would make such a difference. It would save people huge amounts of money.
It would be huge.
And work.
And work. And it would be so much gentler on our land because you're not, you know, tilling and ripping things out every year in order to replant. And you don't need the same amounts of fertilizers and pesticides as you do with today's wheat.
Fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
Beth, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Lynn.
Beth Dooley is author of In Winter's Kitchen, Growing Roots and Breaking Bread in the Northern Heartland. And Beth left us with her favorite recipe for mashed potatoes. It was her grandmother's, and you can find it, Best Mashers, at splendidtable.org. I think I have to announce that the days of the Eenies, like the espresso black pepper martini, the Greenland banana martini, and the mother of them all, the cosmopolitan, well, those days are over. Now it's handmade ingredients, dizzying innovations, and at the same time, a new respect for traditional drinks like the old-fashioned. One man, Robert Simonson, the New York Times cocktail and spirits writer, has been tracking these changes. He's written A Proper Drink, the untold story of how a band of bartenders saved the civilized drinking world. Robert talked to our correspondent, Joe Yonan, food and dining editor of The Washington Post.
Hi, Robert. Thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure to be here.
So you have written this book about so many cocktails and the stories behind them and the cocktail renaissance. But I want to start by talking to you about a cocktail that, well, everybody loves to hate, which is the cosmopolitan.
It's a good place to start.
So how did it come about? Who invented the Cosmo?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. You would think in our day and age where, like, everything that we do is thoroughly accounted for in a million media that we would know exactly who invented the cosmopolitan. But for some time now, there have been at least three claimants to this drink, and people continue to argue about it to this day. I did a thorough research into the cosmopolitan because I felt it was an important drink. It's kind of like a proto-modern classic, you know, one that preceded all the other modern classic cocktails that followed it. And I interviewed all the people who said that they had invented it. And I took a stand. I said that a man named Toby Cicchini invented the cosmopolitan in 1988 at the Odeon in New York. And this has emerged as the initial controversy coming out of the book, because there are some people who say it was invented by this woman named Cheryl Cook, who is a bartender down in Miami. But the thing is, it has to date from 1988, because that's when the Absolut Vodka Company introduced Absolut Citron the market. And you can't make the drink without Absolut Citron. That was one of the first flavored vodkas.
Right, right. Now, why do modern bartenders hate it so much?
I think there are a trio of reasons. There's a natural hatred that bartenders have for a drink that they have to make a million times. They get really sick of that. Another reason is when the modern mixology trend began in the late 90s and early aughts, one of their badges of honor was using good quality ingredients. And they wanted to use fresh juice instead of sour mix. They wanted to use good quality liquor. And the Cosmopolitan called for a couple things that they were against. One was flavored vodka, which they considered artificial. And the second was cranberry juice cocktail, which they also considered an artificial ingredient. A lot of the more principled bars in the early years would not even carry cranberry juice behind the bar so that they had an excuse that they could give to the customers when they ordered a Cosmopolitan. They say, well, I'm sorry, we can't make that.
I mean, even the fact that it's based on vodka is probably a problem for a lot of them, right?
Yes. In the early years, vodka was the enemy. You have to remember that vodka is the number one spirit in America. More people drink vodka than anything else. That's still true today, and it certainly was true in the 80s and 90s. These bartenders were trying to get customers to broaden their palate, you know, try some bourbon, try some rye, tequila, mezcal, these other things that were out there.
Well, another vodka drink that you write about in the book that has an interesting story is the vodka espresso, which some of us think of as an espresso martini.
Almost everyone calls it an espresso martini.
Right. I'm not sure I've ever had a good one.
And that is a drink you can get all over the world. It's fresh espresso and vodka and coffee liqueur. That was invented by a guy named Dick Bradsell, who was the leader of the London cocktail revival. He was the guy that inspired everybody. He trained hundreds of bartenders. And he invented this cocktail in the 80s, and he worked in a lot of private clubs that were frequented by celebrities, including supermodels. And this drink was created on the request of a supermodel. He's never identified who. Some people speculated it was Kate Moss, but, I mean, she would have been 13 at the time, but you never, who knows?
I'm going with Linda Evangelista.
Oh, that's a good choice. Hmm. And the model said she wanted a drink that would first wake her up and then screw her up, although she didn't use those exact words. And that's what Dick Bradsell came up with.
Robert, one of the things that these bartenders have done, of course, is reintroduce us to some lost cocktails. Yes. And some of them have become pretty popular. Like one of my favorites is an Aviation. Gin, lemon, maraschino, cream de violette.
Yes.
That was a pre-prohibition gin drink, right? How did it come to be revived, and how did it get to be kind of hip?
Yeah, the Aviation was one of the early poster child cocktails of the mixology movement. There were a few of these. That drink was known, but it wasn't completely understood until somebody uncovered a cocktail book that was published right before Prohibition that included a recipe for the Aviation, and it had that critical ingredient, that missing ingredient, the creme de violette, which gives the drink a kind of a purple hue. Now, that's a gin cocktail, and in the early days of the mixology movement, you know, they were trying to get everyone to drink gin instead of vodka. So that's one of the reasons why it started appearing on a lot of menus, and bartenders started pushing it, and it became a trendy drink. And now I think it's kind of safely thought of as a classic. If you go into a good bar, you can order it and be safe in the idea that the bartender knows how to make it.
Well, one thing that struck me as I was reading about all the drinks that spread from bartender to bartender and bar to bar and the conflicting accounts of who invented them was none of them seem to be considered the property of those bartenders. So I suppose there's no copywriting a cocktail?
No, you cannot copyright a recipe.
Right. It seems like the inventors of the drinks don't seem to be all that proprietary about them either. Is it just camaraderie in the bartending world?
They are proprietary. They want to be credited correctly. If you created the cocktail and the cocktail appears on another menu somewhere else, you know, it's supposed to be common courtesy that you put the name of the bartender under it so people know where that drink came from. But they are very good at sharing the recipes. I think they've learned their lessons from the past. There was a whole section of the cocktail history, the tiki movement, that because the bartenders kept their recipes secret, almost all those recipes were almost lost. You know, and like, there's a historian named Jeff Berry, and he had to dig and dig and dig for years to find out how to properly make a zombie because nobody knew anymore. So the bartenders today are very good at sharing cocktails. If I was a bartender and I went into a bar and I tasted this great drink, this is fantastic, I would just go to the bartender and say, I would love to put this on my menu. I'll give you credit. Do you mind sharing the recipe? And I'm sure they would. I've never heard that they don't.
Robert, thank you so much for talking to us about this. It's fascinating stuff.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Robert Simonson is author of A Proper Drink. Joe Yonan's latest book is Eat Your Vegetables, Bold Recipes for the Single Cook. Now, head to splendidtable.org to browse through our cocktail recipes, including two from Robert Simonson's book, An Aviation and the classic Suffering Bastard. It's all there at splendidtable.org. Coming up, conversation with you and an answer to the question, is the professional restaurant critic an endangered species? I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
The number you have reached has been disconnected.
Okay, it's time for us to talk. Now, connect up with us. You can find us at Facebook and Twitter or call 800-537-5252, just like Rich from State College, Pennsylvania just did. Hey, Rich, welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Hi there, Lynn. Well, first of all, it's a privilege to speak to you, and I love listening to your show. So,
thank you.
We were traveling in Italy in May, about 18 days, and, you know, ate our way from Rome to Florence to Vienna, to Venice, Milan. Uh-huh. And, you know, I wanted to bring everything back with me, of course.
Oh, yeah. But this sounds like a great hardship.
Oh, it was terrible.
I can understand. Yeah. Somebody has to do it.
Exactly. What I am actually suffering with now, I shouldn't say suffering, but trying to wrestle with, is how to perfect our favorite dish from Rome, which is cacio e pepe.
Aha, the pasta with cheese and black pepper.
Yes.
Okay. Now, this is a real tricky thing to do. You know, when there are four ingredients, then it gets tough. When there are 20, you can fudge and play and, you know, you have more leeway. But
exactly.
I want to know, because different people do this differently. It's such a classic dish for that area. Tell me what you remember about it.
I remember the creaminess and the richness. And I actually asked some of the restaurants we were in, you know, what is behind this dish?
Yeah.
And most of the answers that I got were, you know, there's no cream, no butter, no oil.
Right.
And we only use pecorino romano and pepper. And that was basically what they were telling me. And, you know, I came home and we tried a few of these recipes. And it's not that I'm failing miserably, but I cannot seem to get that creamy texture. So do you think some of the restaurants were pulling my leg and adding some butter and cream?
No. In fact, I have to say that in dishes like that, okay, pasta combinata, by the way, is sort of the son of cacio e pepe. And cacio means cheese, and of course, pepper means pepper. It's a violation to put cream in carbonara. Because these were always simple dishes, and they don't come from an area where cream goes into things, you know, at the drop of a hat.
And that's what I thought.
Yeah, and in fact, I can remember a friend of mine, a culinary journalist in Italy, said, "When will people understand that there are special places in hell for people who add cream to dishes that would never, ever be made with cream?" Here's the deal. They left out the third ingredient when they told you.
Mm-hmm.
The third ingredient is pasta water.
Wow.
And the idea behind the dish is that you have a good pecorino romano, okay? You grate a generous amount of it. It goes into the pasta bowl. And then just before you pull the pasta out, okay, you pull out a cup or so of the pasta water, which now has starch in it and it has some salt in it. And you add that to the bowl and you stir and stir and stir. You could even use a whisk until it melts and it gets creamy. And then you dump the pasta in.
That sounds amazing.
And okay, then you add black pepper to taste. And you know what? Frankly, if you use a whisk, it's going to happen fast because you want everything to be hot. But that's the key. The three ingredients, the pasta water is the key third ingredient.
Fantastic.
Enjoy the dish. It is one of the great classics.
Well, it's my favorite, so I look forward to trying this out, and I will let you know.
All right. I'd love that.
Great.
Thank you. Take
Thank
care,
you so
Rich.
Much. Bye-bye.
We have Donna calling from Denver. Donna, what is on your mind?
Well, I am putting my garden away for fall.
Uh-huh.
And that means I have a ton of seeds, especially my favorite fennel seeds. Yes. And I'm so ready to use them for something that I'm not used to doing because there's so many. I mean, I'll use them in soups and stews and everything
right.
like that. But I'm thinking there's got to be something I haven't tried yet, like maybe a sweet
Well, I have an idea. A couple of evenings ago, I did a cooking class, and I did a plagiarization from one of our wonderful restaurants. It's called The Bachelor Farmer, and they do a toast course where it's their homemade bread that they've toasted on a grill, and it comes on a plank of wood with a special stand so the toast, you know, stands up. And then there are all kinds of interesting things to put on the toast, and one of them is their homemade fresh cheese, which is like a very lush, creamy cottage cheese, and they make it fresh every day. But the point was, I was making a salad for this menu in this cooking class, and I decided that I would plagiarize that idea because not only is that toast delicious, a whole grain, you know, rustic kind of toast, but and you could use ricotta, quark, you know, anything you'd like, or you could make your own cheese if you want to because it's not hard.
I love making ricotta. I have found that it's easy and very satisfying.
It's fabulous. Fabulous.
So 165 degrees, curdle it, done.
You're done. Yes, exactly. Exactly. But the idea is what they top their cheese with. They have a little bowl. Equal parts, this is my interpretation, of flax seed and fennel seed. And you put that, yes, and you put that in a skillet with a very small amount of sugar, a bit of salt, and a bit of pepper. Now, if you want to get really sexy, you can do a little bit of fresh ground allspice. And you warm that, no fat goes in the pan, you warm that gradually, and you warm it and stir it. I put it in a big skillet until you can smell. And it smells so good, your fennel. You put that on the creamy cheese. But what I haven't gotten to yet with it, but I think it would be wonderful, is to add that mixture or top something like, you know, a piece of meat or fish that you've either grilled or pan sautéed and maybe taken a little bit of the juices to moisten the top and then sprinkle something like this on it. It would be unbelievable on lamb. And can you imagine it on sweet potatoes?
Oh, yeah. Anything right now, like the apples, the pumpkins, everything.
You got it.
And
exactly.
I'm just looking at the fennel going, it's your time.
Exactly. And I think it would be interesting to do a fruit tart, an autumn fruit tart, where you bake the fruit in the tart and sprinkle this on top of it. I think it would be really interesting.
Yeah.
So, and you know, I mean, I was serving a lot of people, but, you know, a half a cup of each. So you're going to go through the fennel seed pretty fast.
I got like 2 cups of it right now off these plants.
You are, you've got it made, girl.
I got a little more to make now, and I'm very excited.
This is good. Hey, enjoy it.
So much.
Well, it's great that you have all those wonderful seeds and that you're harvesting them. This is fabulous.
Oh, yeah.
Donna, you take care and have a great fall.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye.
You can reach us, 800-537-5252, or send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Well, like it or not, we're in a new age of criticism. I mean, with the internet, opinions run wild. Bloggers, crowdsourced reviews, and rallying cries of, I trust my friends more than a paid reviewer. And they heft real weight. So should professional food critics go the way of the dinosaur? Our managing producer, Sally Swift, sat down with Tom Sietsma, the food critic for The Washington Post.
So, Tom, nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
I want to talk a little bit about the role of a food critic these days. And is it a viable job anymore with everything that goes on the web and everyone weighing in? What is your take?
Gosh, I sure hope that's the case. You know, a long time ago, I apologized for being a food writer, but I discovered that with food, you can write about politics, you can write about health, you can write about finance, economics. You know, it's just open to so many different ways of reporting and telling good stories. And, you know, when it comes down to it, I know some critics were worried about Yelp or other forms of social media where restaurants and establishments are reviewed. But I think it's more important than ever right now because there's so much noise out there. Mm-hmm. And there are fewer people. I am very lucky, as is Pete Wells at the New York Times and a handful of other critics around the country, because we have employers who let us go multiple times to restaurants, who allow us to scout restaurants and maybe never write about them, who allow us to go back and take people with us, and they foot those bills. And they are not inexpensive. I mean, when you do something like this, it is a serious commitment of time and resources. And gosh, whether or not I agree with a given critic, I think paid restaurant critics are really important right now because at least you can go online and see what their bios are, what they've written in the past. You can see an entire body of work, and hopefully the New York Times and the Washington Post and other large publications, they're supporting these people or they wouldn't be there.
And ultimately, it is a question about whether or not we value criticism.
Sure.
You know, because, of course, everyone feels they can weigh in, which they can, and it's a really great thing. But, you know, you think about – I think about looking at a movie review, and I know the critics – who have share the same style, are
sure.
interested in the same things that I am in, and can, you know, it's the sorting hat of
right.
sort, you know?
Right.
What do you think the weight of Yelp reviews and the like have been on restaurants?
Well, I think they drive restaurants crazy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I hear this repeatedly, and maybe it's because people who are angry or upset about something complain the loudest. But I guess as a layperson, I mean, it takes so much work to go through Yelp reviews and discern who's good and who's bad, or to find someone who's good, rather, and follow that person's opinion. You know, I always look at some with too many exclamation marks or poor spelling, or this is the best French onion soup I've ever had. And you want to know, like, where's this person eating French onion soup? Have they been to France? Have they cooked it? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And these are all details and things that help inform opinions, I think. And, you know, it's just too much work for the average person. We're all time pressed, right? But, you know, isn't it easier to have a critic with a track record vet a place than someone whose background you don't know?
Mm-hmm. Whose food criticism do you like?
Oh, gosh.
And who do you admire, actually, is really the question, I guess.
Well, you know, my predecessor, Phyllis Richmond, she was my mentor. I would have to list her. Mm-hmm.
Who
wrote for the Post. Mm-hmm. She was there for an astounding 23 years.
Right.
And, boy, those were big pumps
she
to fill.
She wielded power.
Yeah,
no
she really did. She was both the food critic and the food editor at the time, and I was her assistant. So I really credit her. She had a lovely voice, and she was a real champion for the underdog and for just good food. You know, she wasn't one of these critics who only wanted to eat in high-end places. In fact, she really preferred that. She told me not too long ago that if she were to do it all over again, she'd want to be the cheap eats critic. And I admire her for that. She had a good sense of humor and always was always inquisitive and asked good questions and everything. I think Jonathan Gold, obviously, he won a Pulitzer Prize mm-hmm. for his work, is really good.
Who also loves cheap eats, interestingly enough.
Who also loves cheap eats, right? Yeah, I think, you know, what do they tell us? You know, write about what you know. And he's really made a career for himself, you know, eating low on the food scale there. Ruth Reichel, I think her stuff is just really poetic. And then going way far back, I think I was a fan of Mimi Sheraton's back when she was the food critic for the New York Times. But I could go on and on. You know, I hate to, you know, I have a lot of friends around the country.
No, I understand.
It's just a really hard job to do well because basically you're writing about what you're putting in your mouth and chewing and how to make that come alive week after week.
Be relevant.
Be relevant. Stay on point. Be fair. Be funny. You know, I think it's really important to be a good read, though. I mean, the food stuff you can learn. It's sort of like being a good waiter. I would hire the person who has the better personality and fewer skills than the person who has more skills and not much of a personality, because it doesn't matter how much you know about food if you can't spin a good tale for readers, no one's going to follow you.
Tom, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom Sietsma is the food critic for The Washington Post. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Well, thanks for joining us. And until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Mary Kayash, who said, "Sandwich every bit of criticism between two layers of praise." SplendidTable.org has just about everything you will ever need. Recipes, extended interviews with the likes of folks like Marcus Samuelson. And you can register for our giveaways and our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. And if you like what you heard here today, be sure to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast app. For a daily dose of food inspiration, make sure you're following us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.